Nuclear waste madness. It's not just limited to the battle over the so-called interim storage sites in the U.S. Southwest. The U.K. has its own version at Sellafield in Cumbria, 250 miles from London. It's in a remote central location with the Irish Sea on one side and the mountains of the Lake District on the other. Sellafield receives all the country's nuclear waste, and more besides, and is already leaking radioactive water into the Irish Sea. But now, they've come up with a new brainstorm for dealing with the waste. And it takes a genuine expert on the impact of nuclear on the marine environment to tell us...
They've got nowhere to put it, keep it safe. So they want to build an underground repository. Now, this underground repository is kind of the size of a small county. And because there's been a long history of protest in the UK about having them on dry land, so the latest trick is, we'll have an opening on dry land on the coast, and we'll dig a tunnel, and we'll excavate a huge cavern under the seabed, and we'll put it there.
Well, there are so many reasons why that is not a good idea. And when you learn about all of them from marine biologist Tim Deer Jones, you get another glimpse of what we face because of that terrible, awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with UK-based marine biologist Tim Deer Jones. He is a radiation researcher and consultant who specializes in analysis of the radiation threats to our planet's waters from a wide range of nuclear sources. Here, we hone in on Sellafield in the UK, both the current problems and some of their wackier projections for what they want to do with the nuclear waste. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons with the ICAN update, and more honest nuclear information than was contained in all 940 pages of the just-passed U.S. billionaire's bill. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 8, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. A few headlines. Extension and expansion of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, providing government funds to those who were harmed by exposure to World War II legacy weapons waste, has passed as part of the president's 3B bill. The New Mexico Environmental Department has temporarily paused a plan to vent 30,000 curies of radioactive tritium into the air this summer. And both France and Switzerland have shut down nuclear power plants amid a scorching heat wave that has heated their cooling water so much that it can't cool the reactors. We'll have more on these stories in the coming weeks. With the 80th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki only a month away, here's Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, with an interview on their just-launched program, the Children's Peace Memorial, commemorating those killed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
This is Alistair Burnett from ICAN in Geneva with the latest news from the campaign. The big news this month is that ICAN has launched a unique online Children's Peace Memorial for the 80th anniversary of the invention and first use of nuclear weapons. It honours the 38,000 children who were killed in the US atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The memorial features profiles of 400 children who've been identified, and we're asking for visitors to fold a paper crane and send it to decision makers in their country, calling on them to join the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons if they haven't already done so. It can be found at www.childrenspeacememorial.org. I'll have more on this in a moment. It's been a busy month for us here in Geneva. On the 13th of June, we published our annual Global Nuclear Weapons Spending Report, which I told you was coming last month. In 2024, the nine nuclear-armed countries spent over $100 billion, with the US spending more than all the other eight combined. China was the second biggest spender, and the UK replaced Russia with the third biggest outlay on modernizing its arsenal. By chance, the report was published on the same day Israel launched its surprise attack on Iran and its nuclear facilities, which the US joined a week later. At the time of recording this, a ceasefire is holding, but it's unclear whether talks between Washington and Tehran over concerns that Iran's nuclear program will resume. Iran suspended them after the Israeli attack started, and it was clear the US was supporting Israel. ICAN experts gave many media interviews calling for the illegal attacks to stop and a return to diplomacy as a way of resolving the international concern over Tehran's nuclear program, which Iran says is for peaceful purposes. Israel and President Trump ignored the fact that both the IAEA and US intelligence agencies continue to assess that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, and Iran certainly doesn't have any nuclear weapons. The fear now is the attack will strengthen voices in Iran that are calling for the country to get nuclear weapons in order to deter Israel. On June 21st, ICAN representatives accompanied Tu Hibakusha on a visit to the house in Reykjavik, Iceland, where President Reagan met President Gorbachev for talks that led to a breakthrough in arms control and the start of deep cuts to their arsenals. Together with the Hibakusha, we called on their successors, Presidents Trump and Putin, to meet and finish the job started 39 years ago in Iceland. Now back to the Children's Peace Memorial. I spoke to ICAN's treaty coordinator, Tim Wright, who led the project to create the memorial, and I asked him how the idea came to him.
I first had the idea several years ago, actually, when I was listening to a speech by Setsuko Thurlow. She's a Hiroshima atomic bomb survivor who's been very active in our campaign from the very beginning and has been speaking out for nuclear disarmament almost all of her life. She was 13 years old when she survived the atomic bombing. And she, at this speech, held up a sign which had the names of 351 students and a few teachers from her school who were killed in the bombing. And she asked everyone in the audience to think of these names as individual human beings who were going about their lives that day until 8:15 a.m. And I think that when we talk about nuclear weapons and when we hear very large numbers, you know, there are some 38,000 children in total who were killed in the two cities. It's very difficult for people to grasp what that means. But when we think about each of them as individuals, when we see their names, when we see their photos, we can start to imagine the human toll. And so I took inspiration from that and felt that we needed to do more as a campaign to tell these stories of the children who were killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki 80 years ago.
38,000 children were killed, as you said. Why so many? Even in 1945, children were not meant to be targets for military action. So why were so many killed?
Well, I mean, these were attacks on cities, obviously. And, you know, the United States referred to them as military targets, but they were cities that were inhabited by, you know, everyone from children to the elderly. Some of them had been evacuated, some of the younger children, but many were still there, including those who had been mobilized in Hiroshima to create fire breaks throughout the city. These were mainly, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-old students. There were more than 6,000 of them who were killed. So a great many children were present at the time of the attacks and either died or suffered very severe injuries. And yeah, this is the nature of nuclear weapons. They don't distinguish between civilians and combatants. When you drop a nuclear bomb on a city, it kills everyone and has consequences across a very wide area.
Children are particularly vulnerable, aren't they, to the effects of a nuclear explosion?
Yes, I mean, close to the hypercenter of a nuclear attack, there's no difference between the impact of the weapon on children as compared with adults, because the mortality rate is 100% or very close to 100%. But further away from the hypercenter, what we've found through our research is that the difference is quite significant, and children are much more vulnerable to the effects of the weapons, not only the ionizing radiation, but also the heat and the blast. Children are much more likely to die from burns. They're much more likely to be trapped in buildings that are collapsed or suffer other kinds of blast injuries that result in death. And a much lower dose of radiation can cause death from acute radiation poisoning. And they're also more likely to develop cancers and other diseases later in life as a result of their exposure to the radiation as children, because their cells are rapidly dividing and multiplying. And that's what results in this increased sensitivity to disease.
The memorial features just around 400 children out of the 38,000. So, how did you go about selecting the ones that are featured in the memorial?
We looked at what resources were already available. So most of these profiles are based on early accounts that were written by the grieving parents of the children. They spoke about the circumstances of their children's deaths and gave a sense of who their children were. And we have rewritten those accounts. Many of them are being made available in English and online for the first time. But we really wanted to show a diversity of experiences. You know, there were some children who died instantly because they were very close to the hypercenter and their remains were never found. There were others who died, you know, hours or days or weeks after the attacks. There were some who were reunited with their parents, others who spent their final days without any loved ones around them in kind of relief stations that were set up. We wanted to make sure that there was a good representation of the children from Nagasaki. There's much more literature that's been written about the bombing of Hiroshima, so we found it more difficult to create the profiles for the children of Nagasaki, but we wanted to make sure that they weren't overlooked. We also wanted to make sure that some of the children of Korean descent, of which there were many in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were featured in the memorial. Some of the children were born in the United States. And also to show a broad age range. So the youngest child in the memorial was born just a few hours before the attack on Hiroshima. Her father left the house to farewell the midwife, and when he returned moments later, the house had collapsed, and the mother and baby girl were trapped inside along with the girl's 2-year-old sister, and all three of them died. So that's the kind of broad range of experiences that we've tried to show through this memorial.
So, I mean, apart from honoring the children who died, what else are you hoping will come out of the establishment of this memorial?
Well, we hope that it will increase public awareness about the devastating toll of the nuclear bombings on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also more generally, the impacts of nuclear weapons, with the ultimate objective of spurring action to eliminate them. We want to ensure that no one else ever suffers the effects of the use of these weapons, and the only way to do that is to get rid of them completely. So much of the discussion about the nuclear bombings focuses on the military history, these kind of political debates, but we need to really refocus people's attention on the human toll of them. And when we do that, I think that we can change the discourse, change the understanding of nuclear weapons, and that's how we're going to ultimately get rid of them.
That was Tim Wright, and this is Alistair Burnett, ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We have an ICANN video of one of the child survivors of Hiroshima that is part of their Children's Peace Memorial. It's up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 732. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, as we come up on the 80th anniversaries of the start of the atomic age, the Trinity test in New Mexico on July 16, the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6 and 9, as well as the recent bombings by the U.S. of Iran, nuclear is in the forefront of the news. And that hot button is being pushed in news stories, many of which range from ill-informed to naive, to hysterical, to callously warmongering. Now is not the time to deal with approximations of the nuclear truth. We need hard facts from knowledgeable, genuine experts. And that's what you're going to get from Nuclear Hot Seat. Different perspectives than what you might be getting from mainstream media to help you understand what's happening, why, and even a little bit about what we can do about it. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we seek to provide verifiable nuclear information and interviews with people who are genuine experts on the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you stories of activists on the front lines around the world, their triumphs and challenges, and what any one of us can do to join these efforts. But Nuclear Hot Seat cannot survive without your support, meaning donations. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, the exact right time to donate would be right now. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go right now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Every nuclear reactor creates highly radioactive waste that is deadly for tens of thousands of years. And yet, still, there is no safe way to dispose of that waste in a way that will isolate it and protect life on Earth from it. But that doesn't mean nuclear interests don't try to convince us that they've got things handled, even though they most assuredly have not. One example is at Sellafield in the UK, a massive site for handling nuclear waste that is currently leaking radioactive water into the Irish Sea. It's just one aspect of the problems there, as enumerated by UK-based marine biologist, researcher, and consultant Tim Deer Jones. He specializes in analysis of the radiation threats to our planet's waters from a wide range of nuclear sources. Here, he fills us in on the latest on Sellafield, the UK's current nuclear dump site. I spoke with Tim Deer Jones on Friday, July 4th, 2025. Tim Deer Jones, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. The information may not be great, but you always are. So welcome back to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby, and back to you with all the nice stuff.
We were in contact a few months ago about developments at Sellafield in the UK. I know that you were working with Marianne Birkby of Radiation Free Lakeland on several issues around Sellafield. So give us first an overview as to what those points were that got us interested in talking with each other again.
Sellafield's been a long-term problem for those of us who live on the Irish Sea coasts. and its discharges made the Irish Sea one of the most radioactive sea areas in the world. But there are particular concerns at the moment. There are three particular issues which are giving us cause for more excitable concern. One, quite recently, a leak has emerged running from an underground source into a local harbour. And at the first instant, it looks like and has been publicised as a leak of mine waste water. So it's very orange and full of orangey sediment. And it's actually running out of a railway tunnel, and it's springing out of the side of the railway tunnel, then running out of the railway tunnel down a culvert into the harbour. So the harbour is now literally bright orange. Analysis has been conducted on the water and the sediments. Very high levels of americium 241 have been found in the harbour, and it's assumed that that is coming from this runoff water, which, as I say, is at face value mine water runoff. But what we do know is that the coal mines, it's an area of ancient coal mine stratas, are very fractured, and a lot of the coal mines are so old that they are beginning to collapse. But this water plainly has been contaminated by some sort of runoff from the Sellafield reprocessing site. That's a concern, because we can't get the local council to take an interest. They're saying, oh yes, there are heavy metals here, but they're not really reacting to the fact that Marianne has raised a decent amount of money and had samples taken and sent them off to a US independent radiological analysis laboratory. And the results have come back with these very high levels of americium 241, the only source of which, as I say, could be the Sellafield site, because it's a man-made radionuclide and nothing natural that you would normally expect to find in coal mines. Now, the coal mines are an interesting issue, because at the same time, we have a proposal up there on the northwest coast of England, on the Irish Sea coast. We have a proposal for a geological disposal facility, which is an underground site which is being proposed and looked for in order to bury the massive piles of high-level nuclear waste that we've got in the UK. The obvious fact is that there are stocks and stocks of plutonium waste and americium waste and high-level waste and intermediate waste, some of it originating from outside overseas sources, which have been imported into the UK and the Sellafield site, a lot of it of which is our own rubbish. Anyway, they've got their onshore sites are beginning to overflow. They've got nowhere to keep it safe. So they want to build an underground repository. Now, this underground repository is kind of the size of a small county. And because there's been a long history of protest in the UK about having them on dry land. So the latest trick is, we'll have an opening on dry land on the coast, and we'll dig a tunnel and we'll excavate a huge cavern under the seabed and we'll put it there. Now, what I've done for Marianne's group was to do a review of the available science on the geology under that seabed. And one thing that we do know is that, as I implied earlier on, that it was extensively mined for several hundred years for coal. A lot of the coal mines weren't mapped, and nobody really knows where the old ones are. But what we do know is that there are geological faults there with seismic activity anyway. And the fact that you've got lots of old coal mines, some of which are evidently collapsing, gives additional seismic activity and instability to the strata that they want to dig out and bury these things, this nuclear waste in. And one of the things that cropped up, I think it was last year, was that they had a ship out doing seismic surveys and examining the seabed from above, and they found that ship did actually detect bubbles of methane escaping from these underground coal mines. So you've got this methane gas bubbling up from these ancient coal mines, which was detected by this surface ship that was doing research work. And that, of course, gives additional concern for worry and fear about the fate of any radioactivity that were to be buried in this cavern that they're proposing to dig into this geology that's leaking the methane from the old coal mines. And then the third issue is that quite recently there have been a number of shipments by sea of high-level radioactive waste originating from Germany, which was sent to Sellafield for reprocessing. And the deal is that the British Nuclear Fuels at Sellafield, reprocess the other people's waste, and they keep and deal with the intermediate and the low-level waste. But because we've got so much high-level waste already there, now the high-level waste has to go back to its country of origin. So we've got this fleet of specially built ships, which are based at a port a few tens of miles south of Sellafield. So this high-level waste, which is spent nuclear fuel and plutonium mocks and things like that, gets dumped on a train and sent by a railway down through this tunnel, which is leaking all this mine water into the harbour and down to the port where these three specially designed ships live. And then it gets loaded aboard them and taken, in this case, back to Germany. And the Germans don't want it. When it arrives in Germany, there's been enormous protest from people who don't want this stuff landed. But nonetheless, they get surrounded by hordes of police and security men and pushed around a bit, and the stuff gets landed and goes away to some German repository instead. So we're worried about that, because in 2000, I did a report for Greenpeace International on the original fleet. There were originally five of these ships. And one of the things that I discovered was that they were built with double hulls, but the double hull spaces were so small that they couldn't get people into them to inspect them. And one of the things that I warned was that, because actually one of the double hulling features was actually the maritime diesel fuel tank. So they were keeping the maritime diesel in it, and they were saying, well, this, you know, if the ship gets punctured because it run aground or it gets hit, well, we'll lose the diesel, but the ship won't sink because it's got a double skin. But the problem was that diesel contains about 5% water. And if you change your temperatures by, say, running a ship like that to Japan, it goes from relatively cold northern Atlantic waters into hot southern Atlantic and Pacific waters. And then the water in it evaporates and forms a dew, if you like, on the metal skin of the double hull. And I said, this might cause corrosion. And then lo and behold, 3 years after my report went out, a whistleblower contacted Greenpeace International, I think. The whistleblower announced that they were going to scrap these ships because there was a problem with runaway corrosion. So they scrapped them and they built three more, which are the ones we've currently got. Because of the report that I did before, it's now virtually impossible to get hold of design plans for these ships because the Sellafield guys and the people who are running the ships are keeping it all very close to their chest and not publicising them any longer. But they've shown kind of artist impressions of the ships, and they look just like the last lot. So one of the things that we're worried about is these new three are 15 years old now. So it's about time they maybe started having runaway corrosion. Plus, another problem with these ships, apart from their potential design, the original fleet was built to withstand a collision from a 24,000-ton ship travelling, I think, at 15 knots. OK, well, now if you look at the maritime fleet of cargo vessels, most of them are much, much bigger than that and travel much, much faster. So unless they built the second tranche of these ships, unless they built them stronger than the first tranche, and they've got a different design collision, there's a risk there. The other risk is that when they go to sea, because they get harassed by Greenpeace and local citizens who don't want them banging around on their coast, they switch off their automatic identification system. Now, it's mandatory by international law that all cargo vessels, civilian cargo vessels, must have automatic identification system beacons bleeping all the time so that they show up on radar. And if you're navigating an innocent vessel, you can see what's coming. Even if you can't see it on the radar, you know it's there. And also it can be picked up by satellite. So international traffic control, if you like, can see where it's going. And you can map the movement of these vessels. Well, these guys, they've taken it upon themselves to switch that AIS off. So they're just traveling like ghost ships. Nobody knows they're there. You don't know if you're banging across the Irish Sea in a ferry. You don't know if one of these things is out there and you're going to run into it in a fog because its automatic identification system has been switched off, whereas yours is on. So it knows you're coming, but you don't know where it is. So that's a concern. And there are a lot more concerns about that. So those are the initial, the current big pressing three concerns that we have revolved around the Sellafield site.
So looking at Sellafield, what was it built to do and what happens there?
Sellafield was built in order to arrange the production of plutonium and tritium and the other items which are needed to create a nuclear weapon. It's just basically mushroomed from there. It's just grown and grown and grown. So now it's something like between 500 and 600 acres in extent. There are over 1,000 buildings on it, running 200 different facilities, and it's got 11,000 employees. It's an enormous site. So we don't have an independent nuclear weapon any longer because we're buying them off the US. But it's now got all the waste that they couldn't throw into the sea and throw into the atmosphere. And they did throw a lot of stuff into the sea and the atmosphere. But what they couldn't get rid of, mostly the high-level waste, which is desperately waiting for a GDF, from the bomb-making processes. In order to get that material, they had to build a couple of prototype nuclear power stations, one of which had a massive fire in 1957, which is still amongst the highest rated nuclear accidents that has happened in the world. We got away with it because it was early days. There wasn't a lot of anti-nuclear NGO activity going on. The government and the media were squashed, and the government got onto it and managed it pretty effectively. But by and large, it's considered to have been a very serious accident. So there was a fire which disabled one of the reactor systems in this twin reactor site. And so there's all the waste from that, because they've only just recently begun to complete the demolition of those two reactors. And this is, I mean, they were on fire in 57, so they've been sitting there following the normal process of, oh, we've got some high-level radioactive waste, let's leave it alone so that it cools, in inverted commas, and becomes slightly less high-level. So they're now in the process of decommissioning them, so they've got all that waste. Then we've got all the waste from the two successive programs of British nuclear civilian power stations. So all of the waste fuel from them goes up to Sellafield and gets reprocessed, and the high-level stuff like the plutonium and so on gets extracted out of it. The other stuff is then divided up into intermediate or low-level waste and stored in different sites. So we've got all of that. Then we've got the stuff that for a while they were importing from other countries, which was supposed to be a commercial operation, but it never made money because they kept having problems with all of that reprocessing. But anyway, so the German stuff I'm just talking about, we've had two shipments of three. There's another one proposed, I think, for next year. Big canisters of high-level waste going off to Germany. But we've also done it, a lot of it, for Japan. Japan has been the longest shipments that they've made. So they've taken, well, multiple shipments of this high-level waste in canisters in these ships to Japan. At one stage, they weren't the Caribbean states, and the Central American states refused to let them use the Panama Canal. So they had to take it down round Cape Horn from the bottom of the Pacific all the way up to Japan, back to the places of origin. So that was a major issue. Now, I think one of the last ones that went to Japan was allowed to go through the Panama Canal, because after that initial blocking move that the Panamanian states made, the IAEA bent over backwards to put IAEA money into the Caribbean. And they started a nuclear institute in Jamaica and spent money and gave donations to various other organizations and governments in Central America. So I know that they have been able to use the Panama Canal more recently since that IAEA. Well, I think it was a deliberate effort by the International Atomic Energy Agency to sweeten the Caribbean states and get them on side. So these ships usually travel two in a convoy. So one of the ships carries the nuclear waste. The other, although they're both nominally civilian vessels, the other has an armed guard. We have an armed nuclear constabulary in the UK whose ostensible purpose is to shoot terrorists if terrorists try and get onto a nuclear site and cause trouble. One of these ships has got a naval cannon and machine guns and the nuclear constabulary, and they're there to kill the terrorists if the terrorists try to seize the ship, and also to beat up Greenpeace operatives get in the way, I guess. It's a crazy combination to think that these ships like that, as I said earlier, are allowed to travel around on the high seas with their automatic identification systems switched off. So you never know where they are. So your government or my government might get high-level contacts government to government to say, oh, one of these ships is coming through your territorial waters. But it's quite likely that your coast guards or your fishermen or your air sea rescue people wouldn't be told that one of these ships is around. That's a bit, well, they're being treated like a warship in a state of war, really, because it's understood that if your warships are at sea on operations, military operations, they can switch off the AIS. That makes sense. So that's the kind of equivalent that these nuclear carriers have under British and apparently international law.
What kind of pushback, what kind of fight back has there been over not only the plan to build a depository underneath the Irish Sea, or the fact that there is already orange contaminated radioactive water that is leaking in, that is visible, and that is polluting the area? What's being done to fight against this?
Well, on both issues, there is a lot of civilian, if you like, unrest and concern, both in the immediate area and further afield. But what we find is that in the UK, we're a fine bureaucratic state, and it's very difficult to get anything done unless you get the bureaucrats on the side. What you have is a tier of local bureaucrats. In our case, it's our county councils and our local authorities and our town councils. And if you can't get them on side for a start, then you're up a gum tree, really. So what's happening is that it seems we find that, say, with the GDF, the Geological Disposal Facility, and this whole thing, the whole nuclear issue is tied up very tightly in that area around Sellafield because it's such a huge employee. And it buys in a lot of material from non-employee interests. So it's a major economic powerhouse in the area. So you've got that. If you ever complain about it, the first thing that the pro-nuclear people do is jump up and say, do you want us to sack 11,000 people and put them on the dole? And then they point the finger and say, you're jeopardizing the economic security of our area, et cetera, et cetera. So what we find is that the county councils are very reluctant to push back too hard against the Sellafield powerhouse. And then we also find that, say, with the Geological Disposal Facility, this is not directly governed and managed and run by Sellafield, but by a government agency. And the government agency is putting money into the local authorities, ostensibly as, oh, we're helping you do advisory work and we're giving you money which you can use to fund meetings, etc., etc. But it's also making direct bribes, saying, if you are prepared to consider this and discuss it with us, we'll give you a couple of million pounds. That's a big deal, of course, for the area, because the whole point about having Sellafield there in the first place is that it was, for a long time, a very poverty-stricken, distant from London area. So it was safe for the London bureaucrats to put this stuff up there because if anything happened, it wouldn't hurt them. And then secondly, the area that I live in is very similar. It's historically been very poor and underfunded. And now we've got a huge hydrocarbon industry here, all pushed in by local, by central government. And the same has happened at Sellafield. So government money and nuclear industry money kind of rules the roost up there. You know, if you've got a football club, you can always get a bit of a donation from the nuclear industry. If you've got a swimming club, ironically, you can always get a bit of a donation from the nuclear industry to support your swimming club. So what we find is that both in the case of the GDF and in the case of the leaking orange radioactive water into the harbour, Marianne, who works tirelessly on this particular issue because she's living up there, she's pushing back on behalf of a lot of us, and we're right. You know, we write to the papers and so on and so on. Sometimes the local papers will publish a letter, but by and large, they too are in hock to these money givers who put in adverts and provide fundings and make gala days and pay for people to come round the site and look at all the nice bits and so on and so on. You know how it's done. You've seen it yourself, I'm sure. So we push back, but we're a civilian coterie, if you like, small groups all over the country who are prepared to keep plugging at it. We know we've got big support. You know yourself, there's a limited number of people who've got the time and the energy to actually be writing the letters and shouting the shout and campaigning the campaign, but you have a lot of support from below. So we are pushing back, but it's crazy because you push back and then with this harbour, the whole harbour, there are boats in that harbour. It used to be a small fishing port, but now it's a leisure port. So there's lots of quite nice sailing boats and cruisers there, and they're all orange now. And people are complaining like hell because underneath the water, their boats are orange and they don't know what this water is doing to their wooden boats or their fiberglass boats or their steel boats, etc., etc. The nuclear industry is trying to promote a water sports event in the near vicinity. And you just think to yourself, this is all madness, you see, but it's all part of the PR, isn't it? So this harbour is now, as I say, literally orange. You know, you would think that it was orange squash. I don't know if you ever remember a scandal about an orange drink called Sunny Delight, which was so full of dye that it was turning people orange. Well, this is a kind of Sunny Delight harbour, if you like. And that was all a bit of a nuisance and a bit of concern for the boat owners until Marianne took her samples and discovered this americium 241 in it. And now that's something that she's been writing to the county council and the local town councils, and they're all very much push that one away, don't address it, fudge it, argue against it, say, oh, well, the nuclear industry say it's safe, so we're not worried, and so on and so on.
That's like the fox saying to the hens, don't worry, I'll protect you.
Yeah.
Has there been any direct outreach to the boat owners or any kind of, if not fishing, at least leisure organizations there to let them know about the danger they are facing?
Well, I know they've all been alerted. I mean, people I know from North Wales, which is a considerable distance from the Sellafield area, have gone up there and taken part in leafleting and public events on the beach side. And there have been stunts with people producing pictures of Godzilla and coming out of the harbour and all this sort of stuff. And only a couple of weeks ago, Marianne had 500 leaflets printed. And she's basically a one-woman campaigning group with some supporters. And, you know, she raises the money and they print off these leaflets. And then volunteers go up there and hand these leaflets out. But, of course, you can't get onto the marina, as far as I know, because it's private and it's locked. So only the boat owners are allowed to access. You can't go and stick things onto a boat because you can't get in there. And I should imagine if it's anything like the marinas that I have down here, if you were to ask the marina owner, please, can you give me a list of the owners? He'll say, no, that's private and confidential. And we're not allowed to do that under UK privacy laws. So, you know, they've got it tied up in that respect. It's very hard to actually get through to people.
Is there anything happening on a national level to focus attention on it? You talked about the local government. What's happening in the macro sense of it?
Again, we're in a cul-de-sac, really, because you will be aware of the fact that last year we had a new government. We had an election and a Labour Party government was elected after the Conservative Party government. Conservative Party was very pro-nuclear, a bit scary about putting money into big nuclear proposals. Now, the Labour Party is equally pro-nuclear on account of, you know, its belief that it will bring work and business And they've fallen for the cheap, clean energy, which the nuclear industry has been proposing in the UK since the 1950s. So they're very for it as well. And in fact, they're actually putting money into helping the design of small modular nuclear reactors, putting money into the big new PWR station, which is being built on the east coast of the UK. And as far as Sellafield is concerned, they're all very, you know, it's important. It's doing an important job. It's got a useful service, etc., etc., etc. So we don't get any traction there either. And sadly, we find, I for one, contribute to the theory that there is a conspiracy in the media to shut us all up. You know, we get quite a few programmes which purport to sort of discuss the nuclear industry on radio and on TV, but almost inevitably, they either don't figure any anti-nuclear people proposing arguments against the nuclear development, or if they do, it's a sort of a soundbite snippet. So you'll have like an hour of a program and you'll have three quarters of an hour of various pro-nuclear people talking about how important it is. 10 minutes of the announcer or program reporter doing his bit, and then 5 minutes from some poor little nuclear person who not talking the kind of depth that you allow me to talk to, but just delivering two or three sound bites, and then that's that. And we can hardly ever get anything in the newspaper. And so it's up to people like yourself, independent bloggers. In the UK, that's certainly not mainstream. So, you know, we're a kind of quiet, hidden voice which sort of squeaks from the corner and doesn't get the ear of the legislators. There are one or two friendly and helpful. Scotland is much more anti-nuclear than England or Wales. In Wales, we have a Welsh Nationalist Party, and, well, they do talk a bit anti-nuclear, but then again, where we've got active nuclear sites in Wales, they're all for them being renewed or replaced or given life extensions, because it's jobs and it's money. And it's jobs and money in areas which would otherwise be completely poverty-stricken. So, you know, we're always caught in that cleft stick. We feel much beleaguered and very depressed, to be honest with you, because we don't get a fair voice. And we are convinced that that's a deliberate ploy from people who have been seized and enclosed by the nuclear industry.
Given all of these obstacles and the disempowering of the voice that opposes nuclear, and yet the tenacity of people like Marianne and like yourself, where does this go now? What next steps do you have?
We're in that classic bind of, it's very difficult to talk about this in a climate where our Labour government, which was supposed to have been left-wing and humanitarian, and in fact is headed by a man who used to be, certainly spent time as a human rights lawyer, but he and his government are now very repressive, and they're cracking down on all forms of civil disobedience and protest. So people who now undertake civil disobedience, which even under the last government, which was a politically self-described right-wing government, people who did civil disobedience didn't get the kind of prison sentences that they're getting under this left-wing government headed by an ex-civil right lawyer. So people, an organisation has recently been termed as a terrorist organisation, and with 15 years jail time for people who belong to it and act on its behalf.
What group is this that you're talking about?
This is a group protesting about US planes landing on a British airfield in order to go and drop bunker buster bombs on Iran. So what they did, they broke in and they painted the planes red. Now, we are being told that has cost £7 million worth of damage, which is hard to understand how painting a plane red can do that much damage. And a bunch of people have been arrested and they're facing presumably up to 15 years prison time for having done that. And we've had less publicised events which have been given equally strong sentences. So to do civil disobedience is now getting not a very friendly looking prospect. You're really going to have to put yourself on the line to do that. Otherwise, people like Marianne and I produce reports and we send them out to people. And almost inevitably, if we send them to the media, you might, if you're very lucky, some of the environmental journals and magazines like The Ecologist, they might publish it, but they've got a limited readership. And you're talking to your own group anyway when you write for people like that and they publish it. Our ability to get out and talk to the ordinary Joe in the street or Joan is extremely limited because the media is almost all owned by right-wing tycoons. And then the BBC is owned by a pro-nuclear government. Although it's supposedly free to act on its own, but in the end, it's the British government which owns it. And the national newspapers are all owned by right-wing tycoons who have their own axes to grind and don't want to hear from people like us. So we are stuck. I sometimes think one day it's going to come to going and sitting outside a government office or a nuclear office and starving yourself to death, you know, and hoping that you don't get dragged off the street and locked up for 15 years as a result of your attempt.
This is not unlike situations that are faced by other groups in other countries, in areas of the United States, and it can be very disheartening. And at the same time, by knowing about each other and sharing our information, the odds are increased that we can find a way out or a way to puncture, you know, the great wall of silence that has been surrounding us. So if people wish to stay in touch and get updates as to what's happening in Sellafield, because I know I've got significant listenership in the UK, where would they go and how would they access your information and be in touch?
Well, I have a Facebook page under my own name, Tim Dear Jones. I am in regular contact with some of your colleagues, people like Fan and ICANN, Priscilla Starr, people associated with particular sites and particular campaigns. And Tim Dear Jones at Facebook will find me. I use that as a social page, but also to communicate with anti-nuclear colleagues across the world. So I'm very happy for anybody who wants to make a contact to use that page if they're on Facebook still. If you put Tim Dear Jones nuclear into the internet search, you'll find a lot of my stuff, or Tim Dear Jones marine nuclear even more. Otherwise, you can hit my Facebook page and ask me a specific question. And if I've written anything about it, I'll do my best to share it with whoever.
That's very generous of you. Not a pretty picture, but an important one for us to be aware of. Tim Dear Jones, as a marine biologist, you're doing phenomenal work in tracking what's happening up in Sellafield. And hopefully it will be positioned in such a way to do some good. For now, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. It's lovely to talk to you as always. And thanks for your interest and support, not only for me, but also for the other people you give a voice to. Bless you, girl.
Marine biologist, researcher, and consultant, Tim Dear Jones. You can best reach him on Facebook under his name, and you can access his previous writings by Googling Tim Dear Jones Marine. You can also search out previous Nuclear Hot Seat interviews with him that have covered radiation in the Arctic ice melt, Fukushima water releases, Chernobyl, and more. They're searchable on our website, nuclearhotseat.com.
Activists, shout out.
Congratulations to Greg Mitchell, whose new award-winning film, The Atomic Bowl, Football at Ground Zero and Nuclear Peril Today, has begun streaming on PBS and screening on PBS stations on July 12. Last week, the companion ebook with the same title was published that includes previously unpublished images and provocative material from the film and much more. We interviewed Greg about his film on Nuclear Hot Seat number 726 for May 27, 2025. We will have links up to both on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 732. In honor of the 80th anniversary of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombings, Pathway to Peace is organizing a conference, Nuclear Disarmament for Humanitarian Needs, Empowering Individuals and Cities. It will take place on August 4th at 10 a.m. Eastern style, and one of the speakers who has just been confirmed is the mayor of Hiroshima. You need to register for this, and we will have a link up on our website. Calling all writers, whether you're published or wannabes. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is launching a short fiction contest called Write Before Midnight, which is W-R-I-T-E before midnight. Submitted stories can be about any of the existential threats the bulletin covers. Nuclear weapons, climate change, biological and chemical weapons, artificial intelligence, killer robots, doomsday drone submarines, or anything else. The stories can be dystopian or utopian, pre, post, or non-apocalyptic, high literature, or potboiler noir. They just want you to write it. The only limitation? They can be any length up to 7,000 words, but not a single word more. There is a prize of $3,000 for first place, with $500 each to four runner-ups. And all five of the winning stories will be featured in the January 2029 issue of the Bulletin's bi-monthly magazine. So get right to it. We'll have a link up on the website to where you can find all the details. And it is with great sadness that we mark the passing of Robert Bob Alvarez. He was one of the bedrock founders of the national movement to unmask the human and environmental carnage that resulted directly from the U.S. production of a massive nuclear arsenal. Bob helped found the Environmental Policy Institute in the mid-1970s. He was an intrepid researcher, author, investigator, professor, and an unflagging resource to dozens of organizations and individuals around the nation. Bob was always an ally, and sometimes an accomplice, of grassroots efforts to hold the nuclear power and weapons establishment accountable. He and his wife, the late Kitty Tucker, worked tirelessly to reveal the story behind the killing of Karen Silkwood and to seek justice for Karen and her family. He served for 5 years as the senior investigator for the U.S. Committee on Governmental Affairs, chaired by Senator John Glenn, and as one of the senator's primary staff experts on the U.S. nuclear programs. There's so much more that this man did. We will link to a recording of an Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS, event that presented Bob Alvarez with a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2022. Bob Alvarez was irreplaceable and will be sorely missed. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 8th, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it so easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow box that will pop up. You can't miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and voila! Every week, you will get one, just one email, which includes a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. You also have the option of signing up on your favorite podcast channel. But whatever you do, do it so you never risk missing a single episode. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com with that information. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. We really need your support. Any amount, one time or ongoing, will help us. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with a date that it's over, because once it starts, it is never over. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.